I never believed in the supernatural. Ghost stories were for kids and bored old ladies, but nothing else explains what happened to me that night. It all started innocently enough, just another shift at the clothing store. The place was massive, high-end, filled with racks of designer clothes and those unsettling realistic mannequins. It wasn't open to customers at night, so I had the store to myself, save for the silent figures watching me from every corner. At first, I didn't mind. I mean, how bad could it be? No one to bother me, a good playlist to keep me company. But after a few weeks, things started to get weird. Little things at first. A mannequin would be facing the wrong way or standing where I knew I hadn't left it. I blamed it on exhaustion. I mean, who really gets enough sleep on a night shift, right? But then, there was that night. The night I can't forget. I was dusting off a display when I caught a flicker of movement in the mirror. A blur just at the edge of my vision. My heart skipped, but I tried to shake it off. "It's just your imagination, Eva," I told myself. "You're tired, that's all." But I knew something was off. As I walked past the rows of mannequins, I could feel them watching me, their glassy eyes fixed on me no matter where I moved. The air felt heavier, like something was waiting. I brushed it off and finished my work. As I was about to leave, I heard it. The sound of plastic scraping against the floor. Faint but unmistakable. I froze, my eyes darting around. The mannequins were all in place, just as I had left them. Except one. One was closer to the door, its hand reaching out like it wanted to grab something. Or someone. I took a deep breath, forcing myself to laugh it off. "Okay, this is getting ridiculous," I muttered under my breath. But as soon as I turned to leave, I heard it again. Louder this time. A soft, desperate scraping noise. I whipped around and there, in the dim light, I swore I saw a mannequin twitch just slightly. I tried to ignore it, but by the time I reached the door, my heart was pounding in my chest. Just before I stepped outside, I glanced back. All of them, every single mannequin, had shifted. They were turned towards me. Their lifeless faces blank, but something about the way they were positioned felt pleading. I was done. I locked the door and didn't come back the next night. I told my boss I was sick, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. I mean, there had to be an explanation. Maybe the mannequins were rigged with some kind of motion sensors for theft prevention. Maybe it was all just an elaborate prank by the store security. But a week later, curiosity got the better of me. I went back. This time, I stayed vigilant, watching the mannequins out of the corner of my eye. I didn't see any movement. Not at first. But around midnight, as I was stacking some boxes in the back, I heard it again. The scraping sound, slow and deliberate. When I turned around, the mannequins had moved again, but this time, they were all facing the exit. I was about to bolt when I noticed something strange. The mannequins weren't just scattered randomly around the store anymore. They were gathered around one of the fitting rooms, all angled toward the door like they were waiting for someone, or something. Against my better judgment, I approached the fitting room. My pulse pounded in my ears. With trembling hands, I reached for the door handle and yanked it open. Inside was a mannequin. Except this one was different. Its clothes were torn, its hands worn down to jagged plastic. And beneath it, peeking out from behind the pile of fabric, was a skeletal hand. It wasn't the mannequins moving on their own. They were trying to point me to the truth. The truth that someone had been murdered here, long ago, and buried beneath the store. The police were skeptical when I called, but they dug up the fitting room floor. Sure enough, there were human remains hidden beneath the tiles. A missing woman from a cold case that had gone unsolved for years. I quit the store after that. I never went back, not even to collect my things. I wasn't sure what had haunted me more. The fact that all the mannequins had been trying to help, or the fact that they had been watching me, waiting, all along. I never imagined it would come to this. Staring at my computer screen late at night, eyes bloodshot and tired, I hovered over the submit button on a website promising to find me the perfect date for $500. The idea felt ridiculous, but desperation has a way of pushing you into places you'd never go in the light of day. At 30, I was still a loser by most standards. Never been on a date, never held a girl's hand in anything but a friendly context. The thought of actually going on a date terrified me. But this website, with its bold, almost taunting claim of 100% satisfaction, offered something that years of loneliness had made impossible to resist. So, I filled out the form with what little I knew about my own preferences. Brown hair, blue eyes, tall with a slim build. I wasn't much of a talker, so I asked for someone who could carry the conversation. A real chatterbox. Maybe someone a bit self-centered. Someone who wouldn't mind the fact that I might struggle to string together coherent sentences. After all, I just wanted to sit back and be part of something normal for once. The confirmation email came almost instantly, like it was waiting for me. Your perfect date is scheduled to arrive at 7 p.m. tomorrow. A chill ran down my spine, but I forced myself to focus on the anticipation, not the fear. For the first time in my life, I was going to have a date. The next day was a blur. I went through the motions at work, my mind entirely elsewhere. What would she be like? Would she really look like the woman I described? By the time I got home, I felt sick with nerves, but also something else. Something darker. Lust? Maybe. But it was mixed with a sense of dread that I couldn't shake. 7 p.m. came faster than I'd expected. I was dressed in my best, though that wasn't saying much, and had spent the last hour pacing around my small, cluttered apartment, wondering if I should have at least cleaned up a bit. Too late for that now. The knock at the door was soft but deliberate. My heart pounded in my chest as I opened it. She was perfect. More perfect than I had imagined. Her brown hair fell in soft waves over her shoulders, her blue eyes sparkled with a mischievous glint, and she was tall. Taller than me, even in the flat she wore. Her slim figure was wrapped in a simple yet elegant dress that accentuated every curve. "Hi," she said, her voice melodic. She smiled, but something about it seemed off. Too perfect, maybe. "You must be Michael." Yeah. Hi, I stammered, stepping aside to let her in. She moved with a fluid grace that made me feel clumsy in comparison. As she walked past me, the scent of jasmine filled the air. I couldn't help but stare. But as I did, a nagging feeling tugged at the back of my mind. Something wasn't right. "So, what do you like to do, Michael?" she asked, her voice breaking through my daze. I don't know," I muttered. "I don't really go out much." She laughed, a light tinkling sound that made my skin prickle. "That's okay. We can stay in." Her words were casual, but the way she looked at me made it clear she wasn't asking. It was like she was reading my thoughts, knowing exactly what I wanted, even before I did. We sat on the couch, and she started talking about everything and nothing. I tried to listen, but her voice, her presence was overwhelming. My thoughts spiraled, a mix of excitement and fear. She was too perfect. Every move, every word was tailored to what I had described, but it felt manufactured. Then she touched my hand, and the room seemed to darken. I looked into her eyes, and for the first time I noticed how cold they were. The warmth, the spark. It was all an illusion. "Are you okay?" she asked, her voice now laced with concern, but I could hear the undercurrent of something else. Something sinister. But before I could respond, the doorbell rang, loud and jarring in the tense silence that had settled between us. I jumped up, heart racing. Who could that be? "Expecting someone else?" she asked, a dangerous edge in her tone. I shook my head, backing away from her as I moved toward the door, My hand trembled as I reached for the knob, dreading what I might find on the other side. I opened the door slowly, peering out. A man stood there, tall with a slim build, brown hair and blue eyes, an almost eerie mirror of the woman still sitting on my couch. "Hey," he said, his voice as melodic as hers. "Sorry I'm a little late. I'm your date for tonight." My blood ran cold as I turned back toward the woman. She was gone, vanished without a trace. The realization hit me like a freight train. They had delivered my perfect date, all right, but there was something terribly wrong with what I had invited into my home. The man stepped forward, his smile growing wider, more predatory. "Shall we begin?"
The first body was found by old Mrs. Callahan, who was out walking her dog by the lake early one morning. I remember her voice shaking on the phone as she told me about the blood and the eyes. No eyes. I'll never forget that. It's not something you'd expect to hear on a quiet Tuesday morning in a town where the biggest excitement is the annual chili cook-off. By the time we found the second body, I knew we were in over our heads. A jogger had stumbled upon it, dumped unceremoniously behind the abandoned sawmill on the outskirts of town. Same story. Eyes gouged out, signs of a struggle, and that unmistakable aura of fear lingering in the air. Our small police station, ill-equipped for handling anything beyond the occasional DUI, was suddenly thrust into a nightmare we couldn't wake up from. "Chief, I've never seen anything like this," Officer Daniels muttered as we examined the second crime scene. He was a good cop, but young, barely out of the academy. His hands trembled as he held the flashlight. "None of us have, Daniels. Stay focused," I replied, though I wasn't sure if I was telling him or myself. The media got wind of it almost immediately. Reporters swarmed the town like vultures, and the townsfolk weren't far behind. Panic spread faster than we could contain it. I spent more time calming hysterical citizens than doing any real investigating. And then, the third body turned up, and everything changed. The third victim wasn't just another missing person. It was Sarah, the pastor's daughter, a girl everyone knew and adored. She had been missing for just a week, her disappearance raising concern but not alarm, until now. Finding her like that, her lifeless body propped up against the old church doors as if placed there deliberately, hit everyone hard. It felt personal, like the killer was sending a message. "Who the hell is doing this, and why?" Daniels asked, his voice barely above a whisper as we stood by the church that night. "Someone who's been here all along," I replied, a sickening realization dawning on me. It had to be someone who knew the town. Someone who could move around without raising suspicion. I spent sleepless nights poring over old case files, trying to find any connection between the victims, any clue we might have missed. The town was small enough that everyone knew everyone, but in some ways that made it harder. Faces I'd known my entire life suddenly seemed unfamiliar, and suspicion turned neighbor against neighbor. It wasn't until I revisited the sawmill that the pieces began to fit together. I remembered something from years ago. An accident that had claimed the life of a young man, the son of a factory worker named Tom Riggins. Tom had blamed the town for his son's death, convinced that they'd covered up the faulty equipment to save face. He left town soon after, vowing revenge. But I never thought he'd actually come back. I returned to the station, my heart pounding. "Daniels, get the team. We're going to Riggins' old place," I ordered, my voice steady despite the turmoil inside me. When we arrived, the place was deserted, but it reeked of rot and decay. We searched every room, every corner. And then, in the basement, we found him. Tom Riggins. Hunched over a makeshift altar, surrounded by newspaper clippings of the victims. He didn't resist when we arrested him. In fact, he smiled, a hollow, lifeless grin that sent shivers down my spine. Justice, he murmured as they led him away.
Justice for my boy.
The first time I saw her, I was walking down Fifth Avenue, my gym bag slung over my shoulder. Her eyes, dark and piercing, locked onto mine, and for a fleeting moment, I felt like the center of the universe. But when I looked away, all that remained was a sense of foreboding that clung to my skin like sweat after a grueling workout. They say you need to hit rock bottom before you can climb back up. For me, that moment came one cold January night. I just turned 30, and my reflection in the bathroom mirror revealed a face I no longer recognized. My cheeks were hollow, my skin sallow, and my eyes, once vibrant and full of dreams, were now dull and lifeless. I was tired of being ugly, single, and lonely, so I decided to change. I started working out religiously, paying close attention to my diet. Protein shakes, chicken breasts, and green smoothies became my staples. I took better care of my hair and hygiene, investing in expensive grooming products and following a strict routine. I forced myself to go outside more, pushing through the anxiety that clawed at my chest. Slowly but surely, I began to see progress. My muscles grew firmer, my skin cleared up, and I no longer recoiled at my reflection. But despite all my efforts, the self-loathing never fully dissipated. I was still ugly, at least in my own eyes. Yet I didn't hate myself as much as before. Baby steps, I told myself. One day, after an exhausting session at the gym, I decided to treat myself to a coffee from the new cafe that had opened across the street. As I stood in line, I noticed a woman sitting alone by the window. Her presence was magnetic, and I couldn't tear my eyes away. She was beautiful in an unconventional way, with sharp features and an air of mystery that intrigued me. When our eyes met, it felt like a jolt of electricity shot through my body. She smiled, and I awkwardly returned the gesture before quickly looking away. I picked up my coffee and headed toward the door, but her voice stopped me.
"Hey, you look like you could use some company," she said, her tone light and inviting.
I hesitated for a moment, then nodded. Sure, why not? Her name was Eva, and from the moment we started talking, I was captivated. She had a way of making me feel seen, truly seen, in a way no one else ever had. Over the next few weeks, we met regularly. Our conversations flowed effortlessly, and I found myself opening up to her about things I'd never shared with anyone. One evening, as we sat in a dimly lit bar, Eva leaned in closer.
"You know, there's something different about you," she said, her eyes searching mine.
I chuckled nervously.
"Different how?" "There's a darkness in you, but also a strength. It's like you're fighting something. And I can't help but be drawn to it."
Her words sent a shiver down my spine. She was right. I was fighting something. But I couldn't put it into words. Not yet. Instead, I shrugged it off and changed the subject. As our relationship deepened, I started noticing odd things about Eva. She had a way of disappearing for days without explanation. And when she returned, there was always a haunted look in her eyes. I tried to ignore it, convincing myself that everyone had their secrets. Then came the night that changed everything. Eva and I were walking through Central Park, the air crisp and the city lights casting eerie shadows on the path. She seemed unusually quiet, her gaze fixed on the ground. "Is everything okay?" I asked, gently squeezing her hand. She looked up, her eyes filled with a mixture of fear and determination.
"There's something I need to tell you," she whispered. "Something you might not understand."
Before I could respond, a figure emerged from the darkness, lunging at us with a knife. Instinctively, I pushed Eva behind me and grappled with the attacker. The struggle was brief, but intense, and I managed to disarm him, pinning him to the ground. Eva stepped forward, her face pale.
You don't understand. This is all my fault. What do you mean?
I demanded, adrenaline still coursing through my veins. Tears welled up in her eyes.
I've been running from my past, from people who want to hurt me. And now I've put you in danger, too.
As the police arrived and took the assailant away, Eva's words echoed in my mind. I couldn't abandon her, not after everything we'd been through, but I needed answers. Over the next few days, Eva revealed the truth. She had been involved with a dangerous group, and they were after her because she had something they wanted, something that could expose their crimes. She had been on the run for months, and in me, she had found a temporary refuge. The realization hit me hard. I had fallen for a woman who was a magnet for danger. But as much as I wanted to distance myself, I couldn't. I cared about her too much. We decided to confront her past head on. With the evidence she had, we went to the authorities, hoping they could protect us. It was a risky move, but we had no other choice. In the weeks that followed, our lives were a whirlwind of police interrogations and constant vigilance. But through it all, Eva and I grew closer. The danger that surrounded us only strengthened our bond. And slowly, the pieces of my shattered self-esteem began to fall into place. One night, as we sat in my apartment, exhausted but hopeful, Eva turned to me.
You know, you've changed, she said, her voice soft.
I smiled, feeling a warmth spread through me. So have you. We shared a quiet moment, the weight of our journey lifting just a little. For the first time in years, I felt a glimmer of happiness, a sense of belonging. I wasn't ugly or unworthy. I was strong, resilient, and capable of love. The threat eventually subsided, and life began to return to some semblance of normalcy. Eva and I continued our relationship, but with a newfound appreciation for each other and the strength we had discovered within ourselves. One evening, as we were packing up to move to a new city for a fresh start, I found an old photograph tucked away in one of Eva's books. It was of her, but with a man who looked eerily familiar. My heart raced as I realized he was the attacker from the park. Confronting her, I demanded an explanation. Tears streaming down her face, Eva confessed that the man was her brother. They had been part of the criminal group together, but she had decided to turn against them when she realized the extent of their atrocities. Her brother's attack was a desperate attempt to silence her before she could expose them. It was a revelation that shook me to my core. But instead of driving us apart, it made our resolve stronger. We had both faced our demons and come out the other side, scarred but not broken. With the truth out in the open, Eva and I moved to a small town, far from the chaos of the city. We built a life together, one filled with trust, love, and the promise of a brighter future. The darkness of our past no longer held us captive. I continued to work on myself, but this time with a new perspective. I wasn't striving for perfection or seeking validation from others. I was learning to love myself, flaws and all. And with Eva by my side, I knew I was no longer alone in the journey. In the end, it wasn't about being ugly or beautiful. It was about finding someone who saw the real me and loved me despite my imperfections. And in that love, I discovered the strength to face any challenge, knowing that together we could conquer anything.
My girlfriend Tracy totally freaked out when a Costco opened in our city. Before, she'd have to drive all the way to Vegas to shop at Costco. and now there was one less than 15 minutes away. She acted like this was the greatest news in the world. Thankfully, she preferred to shop without me. She said that I was always rushing her, and that I didn't understand a good deal when I saw one. She ended up going there every Saturday, spending God knows how much on a lot of stuff that we didn't need. Then one Saturday, I had to take Tracy's car into the shop to get her tires replaced. It was going to take a while, so she asked me to drive her to Costco. She had a whole list of stuff to buy. Obviously, I'd rather just wait at the mechanics and read one of their magazines, but I wanted to do the polite thing, so I agreed to go with her. When we got there, she literally told me to browse by myself and stay out of her way. I didn't argue. I went to the electronics section and looked at some laptops and tablets that I definitely couldn't afford. After a while, I got bored, so I decided to walk around the food section and try to get some free samples. If you've never been to Costco, probably the best thing about it is the free food. Ladies stand at these little desks, passing out tiny cups of samples. That day, they had mini waffles, berry ice cream, salmon crackers, and a couple other things that seemed pretty delicious. The first one I went to was giving out ice cream. I smiled at the lady behind the table and asked if I could have some. I said please, of course. The worker was an older woman with deep wrinkles across her face. She looked at me and smiled. "Sorry," she said. "We're all out." Obviously, that was a lie, because she still had at least a dozen cups in front of her. I thought it would be rude to argue, so I turned around and left. I passed by some other customers eating the ice cream, and I felt kind of angry that the lady had refused to give me a sample for no reason at all. Did she have something against me? I ended up getting a couple of other samples, but was starting to get a little bored. I hoped that Tracy would be done soon. I rounded the corner into the frozen food section when I saw an old woman who was leaning over her shopping cart and struggling to breathe. Her face was red and sweat oozed down her face. I ran to her. "Excuse me," I said, are you okay?"
"Can't breathe," she said.
She lost her grip on her shopping cart and fell to the ground. I looked all around me to see if anyone was nearby.
"Help," I shouted. "Someone's having a heart attack."
No one came down the aisle, so I dug out my phone and called 911. I waited by the woman's side, but I could tell that she wasn't going to make it. Her breathing was getting weaker and weaker. I tried to tell her that she was going to be okay, but by that point, she was gone. I stood up and ran to find someone, but when I left the aisle, I could see a bunch of other customers gasping for breath and collapsing onto the ground. It wasn't just the one woman. It was everyone in the store. I ran to another woman who toppled onto the floor as soon as I could get to her. A little free sample cup rolled out of her hand. In the distance, two more customers fell over too. I had no idea what was going on, but I knew that Tracy and I had to get out of there. Something was killing everyone inside. Was it a chemical attack? Something in the air? I had to find Tracy. I shouted her name, but I couldn't see her anywhere. By then, literally all the other customers were lying dead on the ground. The only movement came from all the workers, who were scrambling around and checking on the fallen customers. That's when I saw the old woman who refused to give me ice cream. She was still standing at her table looking at all the bodies on the floor, and she was cackling madly. She'd done this. She'd poison everyone with her free ice cream. Just then, someone grabbed me from behind. I spun around and saw Tracy. She was terrified, but otherwise okay. "We have to get out of here now," she said. I couldn't agree more. She grabbed my arm and together we raced through the store. We passed by so many bodies as we did. It was just horrible. As soon as we got outside, we saw a bunch of ambulance and cop cars pull up. I guess I wasn't the only one to call 911. A policeman ran up to us and asked us what happened. I told him my theory. I think that someone in there poisoned the free samples. We had to answer a bunch of questions while the cops and paramedics rushed inside. Several minutes later, two policemen came out of the building, leading the samples lady away in handcuffs. They were holding her tight because she kept trying to escape. Her gray hair hung wildly in her face, and she looked completely insane. She was screaming too.
"They deserved it," she said. "I hate them all. I spend every day giving out free food, and no one ever shows me any manners. They're all scum. They deserve to die."
Tracy was still standing next to me at the time. She gasped.
"Oh my God, I asked her for a sample and she refused because I said please."
"Me too," I told her. We watched the police take the woman away.
As they shoved her into the police car, she screamed the loudest, angriest scream I'd ever heard. It was like she was cursing the world. I was numb at what I had just seen, but at the same time, I was relieved. My girlfriend and I were both saved from a horrible death just because we were the only ones in the store who tried to be polite.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Think about your mentors and idols, the people who inspire you most. While it may look like they have all the answers, they don't. But they do know when to ask questions and seek the support they need. In a world that glorifies hyper-independence, it's easy to forget that we're all better with a support system. Therapy is a great way to find a consistent source of support in your life, so you can break free from the outdated belief that seeking help is a sign of weakness. BetterHelp has experienced therapists ready to help you with challenges, ranging from anxiety and depression to relationships and stress. It's convenient, too. You can join a session with the click of a button, helping you fit therapy into your busy life. And you deserve that. You can even send your therapist a message anytime something comes up. Build your support system with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.